The Sunstone Theological Society presents Charting the Changes, special women's issues of the Ensign and Dialogue, recorded live at the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Begin, and I would like to really welcome you, ladies and gentlemen, to this this session. And I admit that I'm a little bit frustrated that Stephen's session over there on male issues is happening, and then we have a wall, and then there's this session on women's issues happening over here, and I wish they would be at different times so we could intermingle a little bit more. But I'm really glad to see you all here. It's a pleasure to introduce these two people to you today. Lavina Fielding Anderson has been someone that I've been aware of for a good long time as an important person in LDS issues, and she has some significant perspective on this issue today because she has worked as an associate editor for both the Ensign and for Dialogue, and is also has been a very involved person, committee member, executive committee member of Dialogue. And she's also a member of the board of directors of Signature Books, and so she has a lot of experience in publications, and she's also created her own editing company. Lavina is a popular speaker, and one of the reasons why many of you are probably here today. She lives in a lovely house with her son Christian and husband Paul, right? Yeah. And they have their own little sacred grove in the back, and also have a wonderful tradition of sending out Christmas cards that are done by them and have a personal touch, which is really nice. So it's a pleasure for us to have Lavina here. Introducing Benita, whom I met about 3.5 minutes ago. I feel kind of like I did when I was working for 2 years with Linda and Alan on the book Salamander, and I knew everything there was to know about Mark Kaufman, and I'd never met him. So I just met Benita, and I don't know everything about you, Benita. There are a few things left out here in this little bio. But I do know that she received a degree from Utah State University in American Studies and is now teaching at Columbia Basin College in Richland, Washington. And she's teaching classes for parents of preschool children, which is a little different than what's in your program. She also has been a managing editor of Dialogue and has worked for other publications and worked as a writer for Sigma Industries and the Justice Department. She has two children and is doing something that I think is pretty interesting. Benita is involved in recording current issues, I guess news and books for the blind, and would like you to know that if you're interested in doing that, what you do is let your state library for the blind know, and you can be involved in that too. So here they are.
The Ensign published its first special issue devoted to women's concerns in March 1976, 5 years after the Relief Society magazine had been suspended in favor of the consolidated magazines that were organized along age lines instead of along interest lines. Since the Relief Society magazine had been a women's magazine as well as a Relief Society members magazine, women seemed to feel this loss more acutely than, for instance, Sunday school workers felt the loss of the instructor. Sister Barbara B. Smith, then Relief Society General President, received letters, phone calls, and comments at fairly regular intervals from women who still missed our magazine and wanted it back. She passed these comments on to the Relief Society's General Authority Advisors, who passed them on to the magazine's General Authority Advisors. By dint of gentle repetition, the message gradually reached a threshold. The ensign, which was supposed to represent the interests of all adult members, was slighting those of the women, as represented by the Relief Society. An organizational behavioralist would be able to provide a more insightful analysis of this situation than I. I had worked on the ensign staff starting in 1973 and had been assigned many of the women-related articles and departments, including starting a 2 or 3 page monthly feature of short items called Random Sampler. The initials were on purpose, those of the Relief Society, that included a series of short experiences, household and family rearing tips, and explicit reinforcement for some of the Relief Society monthly lessons, including information on the country then being studied for the cultural refinement lesson. These features, including Random Sampler, had been initiated explicitly because of dissatisfaction from the Relief Society. Territorially, the managing editor wanted to head off the possibility that a women's magazine might be recreated. Exponent 2, which published its first issue at almost exactly the same time, was viewed as not very serious competition, which acknowledged, even as it discounted, the awareness of competition. At a certain point in the negotiations then, when it became apparent that women needed and wanted more, the managing editor saw the best solution as being a special issue devoted to women, but one which the ensign would prepare and hence control. The managing editor also ordered our indexer, Burrell Shepherd, to start using women as a topic heading so that he could quickly demonstrate to interested general authorities that the ensign had lots of things for women. This, then, is the political background for the creation of the first women's issue, which has remained an annual tradition ever since. These issues have always appeared in March, the Relief Society birthday month. My interest is in comparing that first issue to the 1987 and 88 women's issues to chart what changes have appeared over time and which themes have remained constant. I greatly enjoyed the research for this paper. I usually read the ensign in snatches around other activities, so it was a pleasure to sit down and read straight through 3 issues, dipping into selected others. Here are my conclusions. The 3 main women's issues which have continued to be discussed consistently over the 12-year span are: 1. Employment. To what extent should mothers be involved in professional work activity? 2. Relief Society. Why is the Relief Society an important organization for women? And 3. Motherhood. How can women be better mothers? A persistent sub-theme, which I won't discuss in this paper, is the recognition of single women and an acknowledgement of their contribution. Let me discuss these 3 areas comparatively. The Church's strong preference, reiterated most recently and most strongly by President Benson in February 1987, that mothers should not seek paid employment, runs counter to the main current in American society, where the greater education and more aggressive policies of opening professional doors to women has coincided with a soft economy that seriously disadvantages single-income families. I think there is no question that the trend of the future is for fathers to be more involved as participatory parents and for mothers to be more involved as participatory breadwinners. I consequently think that the issue of women's working will increasingly become a non-issue as time passes. However, it is very much a live issue now, and it was certainly a touchy one in 1976. Take, for instance, the cover of that issue. The 1976 issue features a delightful applique quilt in full color created for the occasion by designer Phyllis Luke and, if I remember correctly, afterwards presented to the Relief Society when it was featuring permanent quilt displays in the Relief Society building. The quilt has 12 squares, 11 of them featuring a woman in some activity, and the 12th displaying the ensign logo, also in applique. The subjects of these squares was a matter of some debate, and I remember a specific injunction that there should be no careers. There are also no elderly, minority, or career women pictured. Instead, the subjects are women standing at a podium, driving, sewing, accepting a bouquet from her husband. You can tell it's her husband because she's wearing an apron. Reading a story to her children, riding a bicycle, standing in front of a flag, gardening, posing for a family portrait, visiting with a woman in a wheelchair, and bringing a baked dish to the table. The innards of that issue make an attempt to provide more diversity. the monthly column Mormon Journal, which has also continued up to the present, which features short first-person accounts, was given over to Mormon Sisterhood with the same format. The first item was English professor Marilyn Arnold's praise of recreation, written at our invitation. Since at that time the Relief Society was not sanctioning any team sports for women, Marilyn had been chosen because she enjoyed individual sports like skiing, hiking, and tennis. The important part of her message for me was, "It's all right for me, a woman, to move and play. I do not have to apologize to the world for being the way I am." The next was a widow who had coped with her husband's death by wearing my working shoes, and the third was a sketch by Vicki Burgess Olson on Stina Scorup, an unmarried schoolteacher and the second woman in Utah to be elected a town mayor during the 1930s and 40s. The most explicit discussion of working came in an article I wrote, largely because we couldn't find anyone who would discuss the broad topic of being a Latter-day Saint woman today with the appropriate perspective. I had spent enough hours on the phone talking to women, both as subjects and as prospective authors, that I finally reached the point where it was easier to do it myself. The crucial discussion on employment represents the personal philosophy of the managing editor, which he interpreted as the church's position then. Mine was too liberal. He felt that single mothers, or those who otherwise had no choice, were not covered by the counsel to stay home, but for women with a choice, the guidelines were. Since children do need fairly constant attention, the mother should be home when the children are home, usually during the years before they begin school, and for school children, including teenagers, in the mornings before they leave and in the afternoons when they come home. Giving this kind of attention to some very demanding youngsters generally means that a woman cannot simultaneously be a mother and a professional woman, but a sequential arrangement may work better. Given the Lord's strong emphasis on motherhood as woman's primary responsibility, exceptions that must be made should be made carefully and prayerfully and within the guidelines set forth by the prophet of the Lord. However, even though a woman's most important contribution is in the home to her family, it need not be her only contribution if she has the active support of her husband and family in her choice, and if that choice receives the approbation of the Lord. I would imagine that the Lord would not give his approval with any great frequency, but there will be situations and times when he does. I would still find it hard to disagree with the factual information spelled out here, although it seems unnecessarily agonized, anxious, and defensive. An almost parallel article in the 1987 issue, A View of the 80s, What It Means to be a Latter-day Saint Woman Today, by Mary Alice Campbell, includes personal reports from working mothers rather than an authorial discussion. One mother finds it painful to leave her preschoolers with a babysitter, but acknowledges, "Because of the high expenses in today's economy, I simply must help out financially, at least for now." A second woman who felt guilty because she did not have time for community service understood after prayer that she had been giving a great deal of service to others but hadn't recognized it. Quote, "Without my income," she realized, "our family would live almost at the poverty level. I work not to get away from home, but because without my help, we would not own a home at all." The first woman is quoted again, "We must shed the guilt and devastating dissatisfaction that can come with the call of duty that takes us away from home. If we must work to supply another income for our family, could a change of attitude help our situation? We may not always have to work, but while we do, we should not be miserable." Thus, by 1987, the Ensign acknowledged that the mothers of preschoolers with husbands who worked could also have legitimate reasons for working, even though they are presented as being forced to do so and doing so reluctantly. An area left unexplored is the husband's feelings and profession, the job level and type of work, whether skilled, unskilled, or professional, that the wife has, and the possibility of continued employment in the future. In short, whether a working mother might be a way of life rather than an emergency. The second area, the importance of the Relief Society, usually did not openly acknowledge the problems surrounding Relief Society membership, the relevance or irrelevance of the organization, its pressures for conformity, and the sometimes burdensome demands for service. Its status as a subordinate auxiliary to the priesthood is indirectly a problem in two ways. It is an analog for the subordinate status of women to men in the church, and the ability of any ward relief society to function in a significant way with an adequate budget and visibility depends not only on the relief society president, but also on the bishop. This organizational vulnerability is a built-in tension. All these problems are interrelated, since a woman who identifies closely with the Relief Society would also usually be willing to serve and would also usually feel that it was relevant to her situation. Subordination may or may not be a problem. Some women feel it as a personal outrage, others as an abstract feminist issue, others as a minor irritation, and still others as a non-issue. Women who have problems with Relief Society are usually passive or inactive. Unlike employed mothers and women feeling the pressures of motherhood who are still obliged to stick with the situation, dissatisfied Relief Society members can avoid the situation. However, the consistent attention paid to the Relief Society as an organization in the Ensign issues suggests not only the desire to politically please this constituency, but also the underlying feeling that the Relief Society may not be the organization of choice for all Mormon women. In the 1976 issue, the first presidency message by Spencer W. Kimball states, "The Relief Society is the Lord's organization for women. It complements the priesthood training given to the brethren. There is a power in this organization that has not yet been fully exercised to strengthen the homes of Zion and build the kingdom of God, nor will it until both the sisters and the priesthood," meaning male members who have been ordained to the priesthood, "catch the vision of Relief Society." Other articles in the same issue include an interview with Barbara B. Smith, who says, speaking to the question of how the Relief Society teaches sisters to support the priesthood, "All that the brethren have taught me says that we have a companion relationship, not inferior or subordinate, but companions, side by side. The priesthood presides, but each of us contributes a vital part to make the whole complete. This isn't my plan, it's the Lord's plan. Women need to know and feel the security of priesthood direction." A third article, "Mukluks in Alaska, Night School in Mexico, and Canned Bananas in Missouri," reports on relief societies in various geographical areas or participating in diversified programs. The message of the interview and the report combined stress the legitimate and important role of the relief society organizationally and also its flexibility in responding to local situations. And 9 years later, 11 years later, in the 1987 issue, Marie K. Hafen, a member of the Relief Society Curriculum Writing Committee, approaches the priesthood Relief Society issue directly in an article called "Sustaining and Being Sustained by the Priesthood." In addition to several inspirational examples of priesthood blessings, the author suggests some important definitions of priesthood. She reports a divorced mother who wonders if her 13-year-old son is the presiding authority in her home. The author answers, "Of course he is not. She is the head of that church unit, her family. She is the organizational and spiritual leader of her family unit." A young woman's president felt unable to make decisions affecting her teachers and her girls because she wanted so much to sustain the priesthood. The author comments, "For her, part of sustaining the priesthood was to accept her calling from the priesthood wholeheartedly, to learn the program, to seek divine inspiration, and to love and encourage each girl in her ward. The Relief Society president who welcomes the priesthood to a meeting may be an appropriate recognition of these men, but it does not mean they stand in a position of authority to the ward Relief Society or its members. Sustaining the priesthood does not mean that a woman or anyone else in the church is obliged to defer to direction of men who are not their priesthood-appointed leaders." Since President Kimball had 11 years earlier used the priesthood as a synonym for priesthood holders, Hafen's distinction seems particularly important in this official magazine. A second article, also in 1987, "Diane Dibbs Forbes's Gifts of Bright, Relief Society Strengthens My Family," is a delightful personal essay about the contributions of the Relief Society to her homemaking projects and abilities. I thought it was significant, however, that it did not note, either in the bio note or in the body of the article, that Diane, full-time professional writer, who has worked ever since her youngest daughter was 3 years old. How fortunate I am to be plugged into a network of experts on tastiness, tidiness, serenity, and serendipitous adventures in all that is virtuous, lovely, or of good report or praiseworthy. A third article, A Sanctuary of Friends, Sisterhood, and Testimony by Elaine Reiser Alder, is a specific appreciation of Relief Society meetings, while a fourth article presents a smorgasbord of diverse weekday activities. The third, in other words, in 1987, there was the same kind of attention given to the importance of the Relief Society as there had been 11 years earlier. The third area, encouragement for motherhood, has also received constant attention. The 1976 issue contained an important personal essay by Claudia T. Goetz, When You Feel Inadequate as a Mother. Publishing this article was a significant achievement. The Correlation Reading Committee during that period was acutely sensitive to what they acknowledged that women sometimes feel overwhelmed as mothers, feel guilty about their shortcomings, and feel great pressure from Relief Society lessons and from other women to reach an impossibly high standard. The article itself is helpful, reassuring, and positive, but simply acknowledging the problems was a breakthrough, and the managing editor's successful struggle with the Correlation Committee was vindicated by many grateful letters we received from women who had experienced those same feelings. The same issue contains a short personal essay which compares a career to motherhood and labels motherhood as more interesting, more fulfilling, more involving, more challenging, and more satisfying. Quote, as mother, I discovered that I was often fulfilling one of the most important requirements for a doctoral degree, an original contribution to the field of knowledge. Because each child in each family is different, a complete commitment to motherhood requires that a mother do this repeatedly. Mothers are some of the most interesting people I know. In the 1987 issue, the Campbell article on what it means to be a Latter-day Saint woman today contains a two-column section on the joys of homemaking, by which she means mothering. It contains an example of a mining engineer who changed careers when her first child was born and became a full-time mother. Another example deals with a full-time homemaker who was tempted to accept an offered job. Then no one will ask, how do you do it on only one income? A lawyer who lost her job when the family moved found herself happier, more relaxed, and surprisingly unconcerned about my unintentional sabbatical. A fourth woman defined motherhood as her contribution. What more could I contribute to a world sick with sin than honorable children? These personal voices are all valid and thoughtful, although some of them sound unnecessarily defensive. What seems to be missing here, as with the discussions on employment, are the views of these children's fathers. The unspoken message is that motherhood is solely a woman's decision and also solely her responsibility. To the extent that this unconscious assumption accurately represents thinking in the church about the roles of parents, a great deal of progress remains to be made. The March 1987 issue was within days of binding and shipping when President Ezra Taft Benson gave his address to the mothers in Zion in February. Thus, I was interested to see if the March 1988 issue contained any marked differences that might have reflected the Benson position on women. The women's articles, there were some, the women's articles in the 1976 and the 1987 issues had occupied the first third of each magazine, 33 pages in 1976 and also in 1987, although the First Presidency's message in the latter was not oriented to the Relief Society. In 1988, however, the first 33 pages are devoted to general topics, and the next 17 pages contain 9 short articles. You'll be able to do the math and figure out that comes out to less than 2 pages per article, that have a more or less direct bearing on women's interests. They include 3 paintings, a woman canning, parents reading a letter from a missionary son, and a mother reading to 2 preschoolers, an article on keeping romance in marriage, a biographical sketch of Caroline J. Brown, the story of a dying woman, the experiences of 2 women missionaries in doing compassionate service assignment in refugee camps, the opportunities for service as a single woman, a mother's appreciation of her children, the contribution of widows, and the visiting teaching message on charity. What is missing from this array is any discussion whatsoever of employed women, for which the Benson position might be an adequate explanation, or any discussion of Relief Society's place in the lives of Mormon women, for which I have no explanation. But I look forward to the March 1989 issue with great anticipation. Thank you. In July of 1970, Eugenia England, who was then the editor of Dialogue, accepted the offer of a group of women in Boston to produce an issue of Dialogue devoted to Mormon women. The issue that appeared in 1971 became known as Dialogue's Pink Issue, a reference to the color of the cover as well as the subject matter. In 1982, 11 calendar years later, but only 8 volume years later, Dialogue, under the direction of Mary Bradford, produced a 10th anniversary women's issue. I don't know how you come up with 8 and 11 and get 10, but you know how it is in Mormon publishing. In this second women's issue, Laurel Ulrich, writing about the group of women that produced the first women's issue, said they made history, not because they were the first Mormon women to grapple with feminism, but because they were the first who did so and found their way into print. We're fast approaching the 20th anniversary of the first women's issue, so it's worth a moment to look back at it and the second women's issue to see what kinds of changes had occurred between those landmarks in time and to reflect on what that might imply for the future of women. Several differences are apparent between the two issues, even before a careful reading of the contents. The first difference is the covers of the two issues. The first is, of course, pink. Its style is very craftsy, unpolished, and naive. I wish I had a large blow-up so you could all see it. The picture on the front is a circle within a circle, and both circles are divided into 6 sections. The inner 6 sections each have a drawing of a woman's head. To my eyes, they appeared to be similar to the famous Gibson girls of around the turn of the century, though a few could be construed as more contemporary. The contents of the 6 sections of the outer circle drew my interest. Starting in the lower left is a lineup of babies on suspension scales. Then a treadle sewing machine, a happy home organ with an LDS hymnal on the music rack, a collection of kitchen utensils plus 1 dustpan, and an assortment of women's clothing and toiletry articles. The final section holds 6 books. 5 titles are easily read: American Cookbook, Etiquette, Divine Womanhood, The Housekeeper's Handybook, and the 20th Century Book of Practical Housekeeping. The 6th book is half hidden behind the housekeeper's handybook, so the title is only half visible. UAL on one line, and then ITICS on the second line. Speculation is dangerous, but I'd like to hear suggestions other than sexual politics by Kate Millett. In a medley of domestic images, it's the only discordant note, and it is half hidden. Of course, you do run into copyright problems, but nevertheless. The second issue's cover is bright red and has an oriental air. There are no words on it, other than the Dialogue logo, and no explicitly feminine issues, only a branch with leaves and berries and a chop mark, a Chinese signature stamp. According to the artist Judith McConkie, it is a deliberate attempt to say that since the first women's issue, Mormon women have come a long way. We are more sophisticated and professional and thoughtful. The second difference that's apparent is that the 1982 issue is much longer, about 100 pages more than were in the first women's issue. Perhaps it's just a matter of finances. Dialogue could afford in 1982 to print, bind, and mail larger issues. Or perhaps, as Ulrich implies in the second issue, there were more people writing on women's issues in 1982 than in 1971. Or at least, there were many more Mormon women writing on a variety of subjects. Whatever the reason, there's more to read in 1982 than in 1971. Another easily noted difference after 11 years is in the notes on the contributors. No longer do church callings and numbers of children appear in most of the notes. Only 4 of the notes on contributors mention the writer's children, and only 1 mentions a church calling, compared to 15 and 13 in the first women's issue. This does follow Dialogue's pattern over the years. In early volumes, church and family responsibilities were usually mentioned without regard to the gender of the writer, and in later issues, both church and family are mentioned less frequently in the notes on contributors. This might seem trivial to some of you, but it seems to me a two-edged sword. I'm glad to see women being identified by their own accomplishments and professions, but I'm concerned about the devaluation of family life implied by the dropping of mention of children. The other differences between the issues that I want to point out are the content of the writings rather than the appearance or style of the issue. The preoccupation of the first women's issue is employment, especially employment for mothers. On the back cover is a quotation from Brigham Young, and it seems significant that it's behind all those domestic images.
And I'm sure most of you have read this. We believe that women are useful not only to sweep houses, wash dishes, make beds, and raise babies, but they should also stand behind the counter, study law or physics, become good bookkeepers, and be able to do the business in any counting house. All this to enlarge their sphere of usefulness for the benefit of society at large. In following these things, they would answer the design of their creation. In her introduction, Claudia Bushman wrote that the Boston women who produced this issue of Dialogue were looking for role models other than, quote, the supportive wife, the loving mother of many, the excellent cook, the imaginative homemaker, and the diligent church worker, because they were not always satisfied with their lives as housewives. They were delighted to find support for that desire, not only in the lives of 19th century Mormon women, but also in the pronouncements of a church president. The concern with the question of how women may combine professional lives and family life continues through much of the issue. In Brooke's essay, I Married a Family, she described her personal balance, pursuing her writing career as she raised her own children and the children from her husband's first marriage. Though I married one family and had another, she wrote, none of them knew much of my writing activities. Not only did her family not know, apparently she also put some effort into hiding her work from her neighbors with the aid of a handy ironing board and a pile of laundry ready to be draped over the typewriter whenever a caller appeared. But her work was acknowledged in each of the many homes the Brooks family lived in, with a small room, if only shoebox size, which all the children knew was not for them. What mother did there was none of their concern, unless, by chance, she sold an article. Christine Meters Durham, in Having One's Cake and Eating It Too, describes her own balancing act as she and her husband combined law school, medical school, and rearing two young children. She insisted that her life was not ideal, but that she was doing her best, the best that she could in an imperfect world, even as she dreamed of a better time and place where neither men nor women have to sacrifice home and family for career, or vice versa, where marriage is more of a true partnership. Durham's essay is followed by five selected sketches, one-paragraph descriptions of five women's balances of profession, childcare, and church service. Those range from a dietitian working full-time with the support of a housekeeper and nursery schools providing childcare, to a veterinarian who described herself as a full-time wife and mother of eight children from age 2 to 13. She attended professional conferences with her veterinarian husband and helped out at their jointly built hospital when needed, planning to expand her veterinarian practice as she felt able to do so. In her essay, The Mormon Woman and Priesthood Authority, Cheryl Lynn May described the conflict that arises when the counsel from a priesthood authority differs from one's own inner convictions. The conflict that she used as an example is of a Mormon woman who became a political scientist, despite counsel by church authorities that she could not combine a career with rearing a family. This even though the hypothetical woman was willing to limit or even eliminate employment while she had preschool-aged children. This is quite different from the ideal posited by Durham of men and women sharing equally in breadwinning and child-rearing, but a balance familiar to many Mormon women. Almira Anderson Romney, in All Children Are Alike Unto Me, does not describe conflicts regarding balance between work and family or church counsel and personal ambitions, even though she returned to full-time teaching when she had at least one preschool-aged child, a 3-year-old boy. Her essay makes it clear that she returned to work because her husband was ill. He would die 5 years after she resumed teaching. She concentrates on the joys and frustrations that were hers as she worked in a predominantly black elementary school for 17 years. Perhaps her return to teaching was met with approval in church circles, just as widowed and divorced women today are not criticized from the pulpit for financially supporting themselves and their children. Romney's essay is implicitly supportive of the desires that May wrote many Mormon women had to combine working and rearing children. Romney found a great deal of satisfaction in helping some of her students break out of the cycle of recurring poverty. The only conflict she addresses is between the social injustices she and her black students had to deal with and the ideals of social equality in the scriptures she quotes. She felt support from her religion in her efforts to help her students. Dixie Snow Huefner's survey of women general board members was an attempt to create a profile of LDS women leaders, their education, family characteristics, work and community service experience, church service, and personal interests. Her survey results show that general board members exhibited the kinds of diversity that Bushman pleaded for acceptance of in the introduction. Part of that diversity may be seen in the fact that, quote, half the respondents have a professional career which they are pursuing on a full or part-time basis. She notes that of the 19 working women who responded to her survey, 13 were married, and that the more schooling a general board member had, the more likely she was to be working. Apparently, she hadn't anticipated this high rate of working women, for though she included a question on her survey about daycare while performing church assignments, there was no query about daycare during work hours. And I, for one, would really like to see some work on daycare arrangements among Mormon women. Greta Baliff Peterson's essay, Somewhere in Between, explains her decision not to return to serious academic pursuits or to seek a job when her children were all old enough to attend school. She said, "I thought I saw my roles clearly developing in Salt Lake City, but my present fulfillment is not where I expected it to be. At a time when I assumed I would be preparing or participating in a career, I have chosen not to. While my greatest satisfactions are with my family, I realize that the quality of our home life is better when I extend my interests and energy to some issue, idea, or project. My life is not described in the conventional roles discussed in much of the women's lib literature." She describes herself as between two worlds, committed to her family and enjoying her limited involvement with her husband's employer, Harvard University. And I found it interesting that we found defensive statements about employment in the Ensign while someone felt called upon to defend her decision not to work in the dialogue. 11 years later, in the second women's issue, Laurel Ulrich pointed out that the discovery that Mormon women had not always been encouraged by church leaders to devote themselves exclusively to homebound activities was an exciting one for those Boston women, and knowing that church positions had changed had enabled them to better deal with change in their own lives. It may have been a new and exciting discovery in 1971, but by 1982 it was no longer compelling. It was scarcely even worth mentioning. Ulrich, in one paragraph, links beginning to teach at the University of New Hampshire with her subsequent calling as a gospel doctrine teacher in her ward. The only other essay in which employment is mentioned is the text accompanying Robin Hammond's photographic essay in Context. Several of the women chose to talk about their feelings about their work, and several were photographed on the job. All the comments were positive, from Bonnie Brackett's description of her classroom as the best place in the world to be, to Laura Weber Decker acknowledging that she just adored working, and Renee Tiachin, saying she had played at landscape architecture as a child. The very first picture in the essay, and the young girl's name escapes me now. She worked with Mary. She was in high school at the time the pictures were taken, and it showed her repairing a car or working on her own car. I didn't include this because I know that was a hobby of hers, and she says she does not want to repair cars for a living. I've wondered if she has ever done it since. The contrast is obvious. The subject that permeates the 1971 issue is scarcely to be found in the 1982 issue. Perhaps the writers in this issue, or their editor, felt employment was a non-issue. If so, their conclusion was premature, as we have seen in recent years with President Benson's address to the mothers in Zion. More Mormon women than ever before may be working, but they still have to cope with negative rhetoric from the pulpit. Yet for this issue of dialogue, professional interests were assumed and accepted without the need for justification or explanation. The only hint that there may still be some question about multiple roles is in Eloise Bell's review of Claudia Bushman's book, A Good Poor Man's Wife. And she says, "Bushman is, among other things, the mother of 10, I think it's only 6, the founder of Exponent 2, a teacher of history and literature, the editor of a book significant in the history of 20th century Mormon feminism, Mormon Sisters, Women in Early Utah. Countless other Mormon women are trying to work out similar destinies, trying to combine the joys and duties of home, family, and church with the not-to-be-denied yearnings for wider scope in the world at large. Bushman has told us how Harriet Robinson did it in the 19th century. Let us hope we don't have to wait for a biographer to tell us how Claudia Bushman did it in the 20th. Here, though, the question is how it may be done, not whether it ought to be done. If the second women's issue does not continue the interest in employment that's seen in the first issue, it does have its own focus. The topics that I found most compelling were the Mormon mother in heaven, divorce, pregnancy and childbirth, death, and priesthood. The second issue addresses in fiction the longing that many Mormon women have felt. Meg Monk's short story, Searching, draws a parallel between an adopted teenage girl's brief search for her biological mother and the unfulfilled wish of her adoptive mother to know her mother in heaven, a wish accompanied by a fear that a deity who was mother of billions of spirits would not understand the pain of infertility. The first women's issue has no mention of the Mormon concept of a mother in heaven, not even in the Mother's Day sermon by Lucy Beth Carden Rampton, that draws on the ancient concept of the mother goddess to encourage everyone to cultivate a maternal outlook, to develop a more compassionate society. She mentions Ninhursag, the mother goddess of the Sumerians, the Minoan mother goddess of ancient Crete, Demeter, the earth goddess, and the Virgin Mary, but nothing of a Mormon heavenly mother. I wondered at this and went through the indexes of my back volumes and found there was no mention of that doctrine in dialogue until volume 11 in Maureen Erzenbach Beecher's essay on Eliza R. Snow, The Eliza Enigma. Then it appears in a discussion of whether it had originated with Eliza or Joseph Smith. After that, there are frequent references to a mother in heaven in both poetry and prose. Clearly, there was a reawakening of interest in the subject in the 1970s. Also new to the second women's issue are subjects of pregnancy and childbirth in Judith Dushku's and Maureen Erzenbach Beecher's essays, A Time of Decision and Birthing. I was surprised to realize that there was nothing in the first issue on childbirth and pregnancy, even though Claudia Bushman, in a note to her introduction, said that four members of the Boston group that produced the issue gave birth to babies that year, including herself. Pregnancy and childbirth are experiences common to most Mormon women, but it's untouched. Perhaps in their emphasis on diversity, the editors chose not to deal with it. Divorce was not mentioned in the first women's issue. Even in the section on single adult women, no one was identified as being single due to a divorce. In the second issue, one of the longer essays is Mary Beth Raines' Getting Unmarried in a Married Church, about the process of becoming emotionally as well as legally divorced. Was divorce a tough issue that no one felt ready to write about in 1971? Or is this a sign that we have become more accepting of diversity among Mormon women? The subject of death, too, is absent from the 1971 issue, but is very prominent in 1982. Edna Laney's The Last Project, Loretta Randall Sharp's poem For Linda, and Bushman's Light and Dark Thoughts on Death all deal with the death of a loved one, a husband, a close friend, or a mother. Obviously, encounters with death are not experiences unique to women, but there is more writing on death in this issue of dialogue than in any other. Are the writers older and confronting death more than those who wrote in 1971? Is this just evidence of an aging America, or does it say something about the mental state of Mormon women in 1982? I don't know what to make of it, and I'm not going to touch it. Most prominent of all is the issue of an all-male priesthood. In the first women's issue, Cheryl Lynn Mays, the Mormon woman in priesthood authority, The Other Voice, accepts the idea that male priesthood bearers provide the leadership of the church, even as she argues for the primacy of the individual conscience when a conflict arises between it and an outside priesthood authority. But in the second women's issue, questions about priesthood dominate the first part. What is it? What are the blessings that arise from it? What are women's obligations as non-priesthood bearers to honor the priesthood? What is the distinction between spiritual gifts, which are bestowed upon all believers, and priesthood powers? Why is priesthood deemed necessary for such tasks as determining ward budgets or presiding at the general women's meetings? And what is implied by the fact that women can perform ordinances in the temple without holding a priesthood office? And why have we assumed priesthood offices to be an exclusively male province? In Ulrich's essay, The Pink Dialogue and Beyond, she chronicles her own change in attitude toward priesthood, from quiet acceptance of the patterns she had seen as a child to a recognition of the discrimination against women that occurs in the church. She says that, quote, "For me, learning to question the present structure of the priesthood has been a positive as well as a negative experience. With feelings of anger and betrayal has come a new sense of responsibility. With recognition of discrimination has come renewed conviction of the essential message of the gospel of Jesus Christ. I am convinced that an effective challenge to male dominance can only be built upon principles of righteousness. Trusting the spirit of the priesthood in the church, Mormon women must recognize the potential for priesthood in themselves." Nadine Hansen, in Women in Priesthood, points out that the circle of priesthood holders has widened over the years from one Israelite tribe, the Levites, to, in 1978, all worthy males. She argues that the circle should be widened to include women, and that when that is done, the artificial barriers of dominance and submission, power and manipulation, which sometimes strain our male-female relationships, will lessen, and we will all be freer to choose our own paths and roles. Anthony Hutchinson, in Women and Ordination, Introduction to the Biblical Context, examines at length the New Testament for insights it provides on whether or not women ought to or could be ordained to the priesthood.
The question was, who ultimately determines the content or tone of the ensign? During the time period that I was there, the the editors, who were the general authorities, took very little role in initiating topics, but they took a large role in screening proposed topics and ruling on difficult points or sensitive points in manuscripts that were already prepared. So I would say that the major part of the achievement and the responsibility is the managing editors. And I believe that this is also true for the other two magazines as well, at least it was during the time period that I was there. And of course, since the reality is that whoever the purported audience of any article in a church magazine may be, the real audience is the correlation committee, because otherwise it never goes any further.
Injunction to get permission to breathe.
Did you hear the question? Well, it's part of the larger problem of an extremely rigid hierarchy. Men have to get permission to breathe too, but of course men can look forward to the possibility that they may someday be in a position to let other people breathe, and women never can. So that's a kind of inherent inequity in the system. I tend to read that mostly as, the correlation code that says that there is an order and we recognize that order, and you, of course, will recognize that order. There are Relief Society presidents in the audience who no doubt read that page either looking for ideas or checking what they were doing themselves against it. Would some of you like to respond? Maureen?
So I didn't read the article.
What do you do for weekday activities in your ward?
Most recently we came to the museum to see them. But yeah, he needs to.
The arrangement of the hierarchy, it's the same with the general authorities whose names are on the masthead of the ensign. They become concerned at the point where they get into trouble for something that someone else did that they're supposedly in charge of. And the bishop is supposedly in charge of everything that happens in the ward. So he needs to know what's happening, or if he gets in trouble, then it's not fair. So, yes, Irene?
I'd just like to relate a change in that same period.
Would you like to stand up and so that everyone can hear you? This is Irene Bates from Pacific Palisades.
If this reaches. Ten years ago, a group of women in Relief Society decided to have a book group. And we had our first meeting and then discovered that the following ward council meeting, they had spent the whole time discussing the legitimacy of the book group. And one of the people there reported back to us that the various comments were, number one, it's hard enough to get my wife to read the Bible, and I don't want her wasting her time on other things. The other thing is, we don't know what they'll be talking about, and so on. And the final comment was, well, if we don't, let's make a big issue of it, it'll die away. Well, it did die away, simply because what happened was those who felt they were out of step dropped out of the group. We had about 18 to start with and ended up with about 4, and it did die out. Then came along the Relief Society Pursuit of Excellence program, in which women were encouraged to have these kind of activities. So when we decided to have a book group, we didn't ask permission. We just, Sally Jo here was the one who initiated it, and we were blessed for what we were doing. So there was a change, but it was that permission as seen. I mean, we didn't ask permission, but we were implicitly given permission because it was part of the program.
I have a feeling that this might be a sort of a discussion and question-answer period right now, so I know this thing can be intimidating, but if you would like, since we are recording this, could you come down when you have a comment and make it here? If it's a question, we'll rephrase it. Oh, you can't, can you? Oh, you're imprisoned. Okay.
Whoops. A question for Levina. I was surprised to know that it wasn't an official women's issue until 76, but I do know from a content analysis I did that the messages get much more didactic after that time. Maybe it wasn't a good idea to have a women's issue. Would you care to comment on that?
Well, I think it's quite true that men got more frightened of women after that point. I remember one of our general authority advisors who was new and reviewing the articles that were in process was very much opposed to a women's issue at all. And he said, women in the church don't have these problems. I go out every weekend and I talk to women. I talk to the wife of the stake president. I talk to the Stake Relief Society president. I have a wife. I have daughters. And I can tell you that women don't have these problems. And the managing editor wisely, I think, shifted the grounds and said, well, the Relief Society has a problem, and they will be able to create this kind of problem for us unless we give them this special issue. So he backed off on organizational grounds. But that's one example of what I saw as institutional denial on a fairly broad scale of the importance of women's issues and the validity of women's issues, and I see the Benson speeches as in precisely that tradition, that they're past denial and they're now into suppression, and you know, when they're ready to move on to the next stage, then we will, but all is proceeding according to plan.
Okay, the question was the Equal Rights Amendment ever discussed? It received very brief mention in the second women's issue. That was post ERA extension fight and post International Women's Year conferences and post Sonia Johnson excommunication fight. Just briefly, in Laura Ulrich's essay, Pink Dialogue and Beyond, there are several reasons for that. One of the main reasons was that we had just dealt with it. The issue before was a special issue devoted to Mormons and politics. And a secondary issue was that we were, at that time, Dialogue was published in Washington, D.C. Mary Bradford was the editor. And we were so close to the topic that we didn't know how hard to hit it. Sonia Johnson lived in the same stake. Her Chick Bradford was on the High Council when Sonia was excommunicated. We were at her house when she got the news that she was excommunicated. And I was only involved in the very early stages of planning the second women's issue, but it was just something that we were so close that we didn't dare do more. And then there had that been the big interview with her in the issue before. Mm-hmm. And of course, the Ensign never did it in the women's issues, but it did have the one that supplement that you could pull out. What was it? The Equal Rights Amendment moral issue.
If you ever wanted to know about the Equal Rights Amendment,
it's wrong. Yes. Something to add to this Equal Rights Amendment thing in the Ensign. There was a speech published by Elder Packer that he gave in Idaho, late 70s, 79, I believe. And in that talk, in the middle of all of this rhetoric against the ERA, he says, there are problems that need correcting, there are problems that desperately need correcting. And then he kind of drops this. And to the best of my knowledge, nobody in an official church publication has addressed what those problems might be. And I haven't seen any action on it. I have been more than curious about what he might have been referring to. Any ideas?
Oh, I never know what Elder Packer is.
I do think Elder Packer was, as I recall, Elder Packer was sent up there in quite a hurry and did not have very good materials for that speech he gave in Idaho. And then he went and gave this a similar speech in Florida, for which he was better prepared. But the results, I felt, were equally unsatisfactory.
Paul?
says in the articles, well, both of these, in all of these articles that you reviewed, that was there ever an attempt on the part of the writers or the editors to distinguish between, and maybe there's a way to do it,
Let me rephrase Paul's question. As I understand it, Paul, you're wondering whether there was an attempt made to sort out the products of pure patriarchy and the products of hierarchy that oppress all members equally, whether they are male or female. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's, you've done that.
It sometimes helps to be an editor. I think that none of those issues were addressed in any direct way while I was there, except in informal conversations. And the reason for that, of course, is that the church does not oppress people. If you feel oppressed, it is because you are doing something wrong and your conscience is calling that to your attention. And that if you would just repent, you would be able to enjoy the wonderful blessings that are presented to you through church service and your devoted leaders. And I think that this assumption that virtue resides in the hierarchy and trickles downward to bless the lives of the grassroots means that it's very hard to get anyone to listen to you seriously when you say, I feel oppressed. If I am not being oppressed, where are these feelings coming from? Why do I feel patronized? Why do my daughters feel excluded? Why do I miss the voice of women in the manuals? Why is the point of view of women in the scriptures never addressed? Why do men get called on in Sunday school class but not women? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that this reflex is a part of the general defensiveness to say women are not a problem in the church. Women are wonderful. We love you. We support you. We encourage you in your good works. And don't give us any grief. We've got enough. I think that there is not a valid grievance system in the church to say this is a problem that needs to be taken care of, except in those good situations where you have a human being who listens to another human being. Penny? Okay.
I can bring it up to you a bit.
Oh, that's right. We have more cord.
Let me tell you about something that happened. My husband and I have some sort of audio I don't have them. My husband has the audio dubbing capabilities, and we were asked by someone to prepare a tape so that the general authorities would know what the modern youth were hearing as far as music is concerned, modern music. And so we took a sampling from MTV and from the radio, from movies of real things that teenagers would be expected to hear. And we censored. We took very, very middle of the ground kinds of things. You know, there are some horrible things out there. We took some things that would be typical, but we didn't also just strain out everything. we wanted them to have, because it was going to be played for the general authorities, we wanted them to have a really good idea of what a young person in the church might be expected to hear if he were listening or he or she were going to be paying attention to the media. And we presented it, I believe it was about half an hour long. And we cut it down. We did all kinds of things. We prepared it. But it was out of our hands to present it. And when we finally heard what had happened to that tape, it was never played. Because the man who was ultimately responsible for it said, "This is too bad for them to hear." Do you see what I'm saying? I'm just wondering how much they really do hear, because people know that they are pure and that they are. We don't want to afflict them. We are very fond of them. And my husband and I had those feelings too. Wanted to calm it down a little so we wouldn't afflict them, but finally the one that had to do it couldn't afflict them at all.
In an organization, and I have a lot of feelings of irritation at the patriarchal attitudes of the general authorities, and yet I sense in them a true desire. Last conference, there were talks given by Elder Faust and Elder Kikuchi, in which they very tenderly tried to express their concern for women, and in each case, they told little stories that were meant to express how valuable women were. But in each case, I was able to clearly see that these were patriarchal stories about, they were really stories about men. The women in these stories were invisible. And I have a hopeless feeling that if I try to write a letter and say, "Dear Elder Faust and Elder Kikuchi, you need to read more and know what you're doing before you talk about this issue, because men cannot tell women what womanhood is like," and so on and so forth. And I have this horrible feeling that if I wrote that letter, I'd be excommunicated for bad behavior, because I feel like I'm being treated like a child all the time, especially when I read the Ensign, and or that letter would never get to these men, and it would be filtered off by the secretaries. Could you comment on these feelings? Or perhaps chastise me for having a bad attitude.
Maybe someone else here could comment more directly. My feeling is that the general authorities do see their mail, and that they pay attention to it. They don't always respond appropriately, and I don't think members of the First Presidency, I don't think that's necessarily true of members of the First Presidency, because I think that their staffs do a lot of screening, but I do think that most of the apostles and other general authorities do see their mail. And I've heard awful stories about people who general authorities who've been offended and hurt and feel personally attacked by an attempt to speak to them. I've heard Elder Packer, for instance, doesn't answer his mail very much, but I know that that's not true in every case. And Irene, don't you?
Yes.
Let's hear an inspirational story from Irene.
Well, I got one.
Vaughan Featherston gave a talk in Los Angeles at Pasadena Rose Bowl, and he shocked even the very conservative members of our group by reciting a story which blamed a woman who was working all night sewing at home because her husband was an alcoholic. And he blamed the woman for not making home desirable enough and for working when she should have been a companion for him. Well, I like Vaughan Featherston. I'd met him once at a conference in Texas, and so I wrote to him. And I told him that I was sure he didn't realize how offensive that story was,
And I got a beautiful letter back saying I was quite, the writer was quite right, that he hadn't realized how offensive that story could be, and he made a promise that he never would ever use it again. So I really think it's worthwhile writing. And I know Marilyn White had a good experience, didn't she? She wrote to General Authority once about some primary material.
She had a good experience with...
Oh, with the primary board.
She didn't have a good experience with another case
involving... Oh.
A couple of years back, I got on the elevator in the church office building, and there was a member of the Council of the Twelve, and I had an out-of-town visitor with me. And he said, "Hello, girls." And... And I thought, I was offended at the time, and I know he meant no ill by it. In fact, it was perhaps an honor to have been spoken to by an apostle at all. But I thought about it, and I thought long and hard, and I wrote him a letter, and I told him, you know, that was offensive. I said, you know, you should say hello, sisters, or something else. And it was a brief letter. You know, I know he didn't have time to read pages and pages. But the outcome of that was positive, too. I think you can write. You're not going to get excommunicated. You might not get an answer, but you're not going to get excommunicated either. And it might do some good.
I don't know if we're done with this issue or not, so maybe this is inserting something else, and if they want to continue, but... Okay. I want to ask you about Exponent 2, if you feel that that's a valid voice for Mormon women and how you feel about that.
Yeah.
How do... Okay. One other thing. Do you have any... The brethren at first, I know that they visited Claudia and really tried to get a damper on it because they did not want to have a voice for Mormon women that they couldn't control. Are you familiar with... I mean, how's it going now with the general?
We have in our presence a former staff member of Exponent 2, Nancy Dredge, who will tell us all.
I don't know how much you really want to know. When the situation with the General Authority in the early days of the church was a very good friend of all of ours. He was the General Authority who lived in Boston and was our stake president at one time. We did hear a lot of rumors before he happened to come into town. It was sort of an unofficial official meeting with him. And his counsel with us was to publish as long as we felt good about what we were publishing. And there were a couple of specific things, the most memorable one being not to badmouth the general authorities, which I think there was one other one, I can't remember, but it was quite a low-key presentation. Now, that very well may not have been the case had it been someone else who had visited us, but it's also true that through a lot of the things going around, it was instrumental in the reason why Claudia resigned as the first editor after only being editor for about a year and a half, and then I became the editor after that. And we went through a big discussion of whether to continue or not. And I think, as I heard you talking about the differences between 71 and 88, the times were different, folks, and we were initially in Exponent 2 very careful, sidestepping a lot of issues, and I remember, as editor, always wanting at least one article that had a very feminist point of view in it, but I always felt like it's there, and the people who want to pick it out will get it, and we're not going to make a big issue out of that. Now, there's been nothing from any general authority since then. We have since heard that it's really more that church is not wanting to sanction anything outside of, you know, any publication, any product. They don't want to be a commercial influence on anything like that. And I think they have pretty well left us alone. I don't think there have been any bad feelings about it, but I don't think that it's been popular with them either. But one way the paper has changed is that it's become much more into all of the issues. You know, we talk about the Mother in Heaven now because it's an issue now. Nobody would have talked about the Mother in Heaven in 71. You just, or women, the possible possibility of the women holding the priesthood. It just would not have been mentioned that early on. And then slowly but surely, and we like that phrase, slowly but surely, leading the brethren to a little more, you know, knowledge and understanding of women's issues. And we feel that Exponent 2 has changed a lot. We're into about our 15th year now, and it's come a long way as well. And you may all subscribe. There's a thing in your...